everyone. Good afternoon. Charles Wolforth here with Hometown Alaska. You know, the earthquake and tsunami that happened in Japan earlier this month is, in a way, still going on with the images of people with their wrecked towns and villages and the release of radioactivity from those nuclear plants. And it's heartbreaking to see, and the numbers of people who've perished is enormous. And it doesn't seem that long ago that similar situation with even greater loss of life took place in Haiti. Well, these events really force Alaskans to think about the fact that we live in one of the most active seismic areas in the world. And although we've never had a catastrophe on that scale in terms of the loss of life, we really need to be ready for one. So that's our topic today. For the next hour, we're going to be looking at earthquakes and tsunamis in our part of Alaska. And we're going to be talking about how we are prepared and what we need to do. In the first half hour, we'll be welcoming Paul Whitmore, who's the director of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, to talk about our vulnerabilities and the size of earthquakes we can expect, how frequently, and what we need to know about tsunamis. In the second half hour, we're going to get into the preparation and, things we need to know about being wise about living in this kind of place. We'll have John Madden, who's the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and also John Ahos, the chairman of the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, since the way we build our houses and buildings is really a critical part of our safety. But first, I want to go back to 47 years ago to remind listeners, or to inform listeners who weren't around 47 years ago, that in fact the second strongest earthquake ever measured in the world happened right here on March 27th, 1964. The Great Alaska Earthquake measured 9.1 in magnitude, created a number of different tsunami waves, killed over 130 people, and is the sort of event that we have to recognize can happen here. And my first guest today lived through that event. Jack Roderick is a former borough mayor of Anchorage, one of our founding fathers of our municipality. He was the last mayor of the borough. Also wrote the standard and classic book about the oil industry in Alaska called Crude Dreams. He's been in Alaska for a long time in a community pillar, and he was there on March 27th, 1964, when the earth started to shake. So, Jack, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Charles.
I invited Jack because I just wanted to hear an earthquake story, and if you know folks who lived here, every single person remembers and will never forget where he was and what he was doing when the 1964 earthquake hit. Jack, I guess you were getting ready to go skiing, eh?
No, I had just come off the hill at Alyeska.
Okay. And yeah. What was the first thing that happened when you realized that something strange was happening?
Well, in those days, in the 50s and early 60s, we would have a 30-second, a half-minute quake a couple, three times a year, I swear. And I was standing at the bottom of Max Mountain, putting my skis on the top of my car, and a quake started. It felt like another 30-second one. And I watched this tree, and suddenly, after about a half minute, this tree started to go down, almost touched the ground. I mean, it was huge. And I looked down the driveway, and there's the place where everyone was gathered, and out rushed this guy with a flapping white apron, and he was the cook, and I knew him as an Austrian, and I thought, Austrian avalanche. And I looked up, and sure enough, Max Mountain was coming down. It looked like it was coming straight at me. This wall of snow, huge thing. And at that moment, I don't remember from then until I was about three blocks away, so I must have run as fast as I've ever run. And I got down there, and here was Bill Ivey, Dr. Ivey, and Jerry, who lived right there, and the owner of Alyeska, Francois de Gunsberg from Denver, and he had his and Jim Branch, who was the manager of the Alyeska, And we walked back up the road, and we went to the ticket shack, which I think is at the base now, chair 3, and watched the snow as it started to push in the side of the ticket shack and push up the chairs on the tow, and then it stopped. And then I got in my car, as I recall. I started to drive back to Anchorage and got down to the highway there, and the first bridge there, right at the right, had gone out. So I came back, and the bar in the little town of Girdwood there was on fire, so we all got our buckets and pushed. Am I going too long here, Charles?
No, not at all. I hadn't heard this part of the story. Say the highway's out, the bar is on fire. True catastrophe.
We threw buckets of water on the adjoining building, and the little grocery store, everything had come out of the shelves, but I recall somebody saying there, well, take whatever you want, and you can pay me later. And then I spent the night up in Alyeska, in a big A-frame that Locke Jacobs owned, and Francois and his bride were on the other side of the couch. I thought that was probably the safest place in Alaska. And there were a lot of aftershocks. Everybody ran out the door but me. I nervously lay on my side of the couch laughing. And she would never talk to me again, I know that. But the next day, all of us congregated in the lodge there, and a friend of mine, the only communication we had was radio. And a geologist friend of mine came over and said, Jack, I just heard that your bluff had gone down, and I lived at the end of the park strip.
So in other words, the end of the park strip, the land had just sloughed, and that's where your house was.
Right.
Oh, I see.
And a helicopter pilot came in. He had Asa Martin, a doctor here, had sent him down to pick up his kids, and I said, you got to come back for me. And I remember he said, I can't, and I said, well, you have to. So he did. And so I flew into Anchorage in a helicopter and landed on my front lawn, in effect. If you notice, the park strip now goes down to the north. In those days, it was flat.
Wow.
And that was it. My kids were with Martha.
Everybody was okay, huh, in your family?
Everyone was good. Everyone was
fine. What did Anchorage look like? And when you're, I mean, the 4th Avenue area was down, the L Street slide and Turnagain. I mean, did it just look like a mess? Or how did it look compared to, I guess, what you expected?
Well, downtown, the 4th Avenue was just, you dropped a whole floor. I had my office in a building, the Denali building over on Denali Street, that had dropped a whole floor. And Turnagain, of course, was really the place that took a blow because the houses just, sunk in that stuff. The military, fortunately, water was a short supply. A lot of people, including us, had to depend on trucks with water that came in from the military for a long time. It was a mess.
It took a while to get back. Yeah, well, I just think if it happened now, surely it would be a lot worse. There are a lot more people here.
Well, perhaps. What people have to realize, at least in that one experience, was that you think this earth is solid. It isn't. It's like, it's like water almost. Trees and telephone poles were going down and touching the ground and still surviving.
Amazing.
Yeah, so everything is fluid and everything just acts like that. Obviously, I don't recall any telephone poles or trees breaking off.
Yeah, incredible.
They just moved.
Well, Jack, I really want to thank you for being on today and setting the tone for the reality of this topic we're talking about.
It's serious.
It is.
Yeah, very.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. Jack Roderick, former borough mayor of Anchorage and author of Crude Dreams. And great talking to you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to talk to some other guests about earthquakes and tsunamis And we're going to take your questions. What do you need to know? What are you curious about living in this earthquake zone that we call home? The phone number here is 550-8433. If you're calling from outside the Anchorage area, it's 888-353-5752. And we're on the air in the 2 o'clock hour. If you're listening at 7, we are not in the studio, so don't call. The email here, we enjoy getting your emails, is hometownalaska@ksKA.org. If you're going to be emailing, do use that particular address, hometownalaska@ksKA.org. My next guest is Mr. Paul Whitmore, who is the director of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center. He's been there for many, many years and has been the director for almost a decade. And you can find information about the center on our website at ksKA.org. I suppose I should say, Dr. Whitmore, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Glad to join you.
Yeah. So your center is located in Palmer, but serves the entire west coast of the United States in terms of warning of coming tsunamis, and you must have been very busy earlier this month when the Japanese earthquake took place.
Well, we sure were. The Japanese one was, well, one of the biggest earthquakes we've ever seen. Since I've worked here, it's the second biggest, the biggest being the 2004 Indian Ocean. And, you know, considering its location and its size, it created the biggest Pacific-wide tsunami in about 50 years.
Wow. And I was interested to see that Crescent City, California was actually severely damaged, just as it was in the 1964 quake.
Yeah, Crescent City, Santa Cruz, a couple of towns in southern Oregon, Brookings and Gold Beach, they had very serious damage to their harbors. None of those areas had massive flooding like what you saw in Japan, but they sure had real strong currents and you know, strong surging in and out of bays and harbors that caused a lot of damage all up and down the coast.
Now, can you explain why we didn't see damage here in Alaska?
Well, there was a few places, I understand, had just some very minor damage down in southeast Alaska, but the majority of the energy was directed to the south of us. Out in the western Aleutians, the Shimmy Air Force Base had a very strong wave, but they don't have a lot of infrastructure there near the coast to experience damage, so there wasn't any damage reported. As you went further east in the Aleutians, the wave heights generally diminished. I understand there were some very strong currents in Kodiak Harbor and in Adak Harbor, too, but neither sustained any damage. But, yeah, like I said, the directivity of that wave was were such that the energy was propagated more towards Hawaii and south of Hawaii.
I see. What sort of event, obviously in 1964 the quake took place in a fjord that's basically midway between Valdez and Anchorage, and it set off localized waves in Prince William Sound and that destroyed some towns and villages, and then set off a large sort of oceanic tsunami that affected other parts of the country. What is the event that you look at as the one that is the highest concern in terms of the threat to people here in Alaska? And when you're looking at an earthquake and you see, you know, the parameters of an earthquake, what sort of would highlight your concern the most?
Well, for people in Alaska, really the most dangerous situation is when there's a strong earthquake right in the vicinity of where you're at. There's a lot of coastal areas in Alaska that have very steep-sided coasts near them that can fail in an earthquake. Like you mentioned, in 1964, a lot of the towns who experienced tsunamis, the tsunamis were generated not by the main uplift of the earthquake out in the Gulf of Alaska, but by undersea landslides that occurred locally, and that occurred in Valdez and Seward and a few other towns. And that type of tsunami can come on within minutes, depending on where, of course, the landslide occurred. But there's very little time for warning. There's very little time for reaction. And you know, that's probably our most dangerous situation is when there's not time, even for people who know that when they feel a strong earthquake, they just need to head to high ground to get to high ground.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I guess in terms of what we can tell listeners, you feel a strong earthquake, get to high ground, you see the water going out in a strange way, get to high ground. How does the Tsunami Warning Center let people know that something's happening when they need to get to safety?
Well, we monitor a network of seismometers which pick up ground vibrations or earthquakes around the world, and that's our first indication that something might be happening. We quickly locate and analyze the earthquake and make a determination as to whether or not it might generate a tsunami. And if it does, just based on that information alone and not really knowing that a tsunami has been triggered, we'll issue a warning anyway. And that warning will go out to people within, well, depending on the size of the earthquake, say within a couple hundred miles of where the epicenter is. So we'll get that out as quick as we can, and the message goes to the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and it goes to the weather offices, to the U.S. Coast Guard, to the military. And each of these agencies has a fan-out list. They have a different responsibility to get that message to the public. For example, the weather forecast offices activate the emergency alert system, and they activate the NOAA weather radio. The Coast Guard gets on their radio frequencies and announces the alert. The State Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, they get on, they activate their fan-out list to ensure that all coastal communities are aware of the warning and that they take proper precautions. And then when you get down to the community level, each community responds in a slightly different way. Some communities activate sirens. Some communities activate automatic call-out systems. Some communities get the word by mouth or by CB radio to their citizens.
I see. I want to go to a caller now. Jean, did you have a comment?
Well, I just had this comment. Having started with an earthquake memoir, you're probably going to get people wishing for more. And if they do, there's an excellent book at the Senior Center called The Day the Trees Bent to the Ground. It's a complete book of memoirs of the earthquake, including mine, of course.
I see, yeah. You know, and there's other great books, too. There's the Day That Cries Forever, which is the stories of the people of the Chinega Bay Village. And
yes.
I think the Homer Pioneers have a book where they've gathered up. And there's also some terrific stuff at the library in the Alaska collection, both personal memories, and then also the National Academies of Sciences did a tremendous report on the 64 earthquake, virtually anything you might want to know. So thanks for pointing that out, Jean. I appreciate that.
Go ahead.
Did you have something you wanted to add?
No, that's all.
Great. Thanks for your call. Do you, Dr. Whitmore, do you at the Tsunami Warning Center, I'm sure you've studied what happened in the past, and I've always been curious as to why so few people died in the 64 earthquake and whether that was a fluke or if there's something about, there's some lesson that we wouldn't have such horrible casualties as they've had in Japan or in Haiti here in Alaska.
Well, I wouldn't say it was a fluke. There was, one of the reasons not too many people were killed by the earthquake itself was that the earthquake damage to buildings wasn't as severe in Alaska because most of our buildings are wood frame and could withstand the shaking. Where we had the main problems as far as earthquake damage itself was areas like Anchorage there. The ground went liquefied and slid. As far as the tsunami goes, I think our exposure to the wave inundation dangers really isn't anywhere near as great as it is in Japan. By exposure, I mean the density of population near the ocean itself. We have a much lower level of population who are exposed to the dangers of a tsunami than other cases. But, you know, if you had the same event occur today, there's, of course, a much greater level of exposure than there was back then.
More people here and bigger buildings, yeah. Well, let's address the question of a tsunami actually hitting Anchorage. We've all seen those horrible images of the water just rolling across the Japanese countryside. Is anything like that possible or likely in Anchorage?
No, it's very unlikely in Anchorage. We wouldn't say there's no risk in Anchorage, but the risk in Anchorage is much smaller than, say, in a town along the outer coast like Kodiak or Seward or any down in the Prince William Sound. And the main reason for that is that the Cook Inlet is, for hundreds of miles, relatively shallow compared to the deep ocean. And once tsunamis get into the shallow water, they feel the bottom, and the friction from the bottom tends to dampen the wave energy. So by the time a wave has gotten all the way from the continental shelf out in the Gulf of Alaska up to Anchorage, it's lost most of its energy.
Well, that's good to know. So that's at least one risk that in Anchorage we don't have to think as much about as we do perhaps about the ground shaking and ground failure.
Yeah, the earthquake hazard itself is much greater in Anchorage.
I see. Now I'd like to turn to Sheila, who has a comment about our construction practices here in Anchorage.
Hi, Charles.
Oh, hi. Sheila Selkrig, our former assembly member.
Yes. I happened to do my dissertation on the courthouse and the reconstruction of the courthouse on the 3rd Avenue slide area. But a note is that I was here during the earthquake, and I actually happened to be across from Penny's when it occurred, so I also have a little story. But I will just make a couple comments about the reconstruction issues.
Mm-hmm.
What my dissertation did is looked at the decision process around deciding to build on land that was subject to ground failure. And at the time that the courthouse was built, probably 99 out of 100 engineers and architects would say you can't design for ground failure. And I think there was a strong kind of intent having to do with ownership of property and existing infrastructure to build on the site that the courthouse is on today. And so what we did is found somebody who could in fact certify that they could design something that would withstand an earthquake. And so what it isn't really to withstand an earthquake, because if the ground actually fails under the courthouse, it means it breaks away. But the idea was the courthouse is built on a great big slab, so it would move together or at least break in large pieces, and you would reduce the level of death. But what was interesting about the process was that the actual issue of risk associated with the site wasn't really formally discussed in the decision process. There was a lot of transfer of responsibilities where everybody assumed somebody else was taking responsibility for the decision to build there. You know, the state said, well, it's a city site. The city said, well, it's a state building. You know, the engineer said, well, it's not my decision. It's the owner's decision. The owner said, the engineer said we could do it. So it was an interesting process to see how when the will is there, we can usually negotiate what we want to have built, even if the land is high risk.
Yeah. And we're going to get into more than that at the second half. We've got John Ahu, who's the chairman of the Seismic
That's
Hazards
great.
Commission on coming on at half past. So
yeah,
great point. We will take that up.
Of Turnagain is really important because in both cases, I mean, we have five slides and we've rebuilt on three of them in Anchorage.
Yeah. We'll get it deeply into that. And thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
Okay. But getting back to the science of earthquakes a little bit with Paul Whitmore from the Tsunami Warning Center. We live in this area, ring of fire, where we know earthquakes are common. Is it possible to say what is the return time or the frequency for destructive earthquakes where we live? I mean, should we be thinking once in a lifetime, once in a century, a couple of times in a lifetime? How often would we really expect to have an earthquake in Anchorage that was significant enough to really cause serious damage?
Yeah, that's a good question. People have looked at the historical recurrence rates for an earthquake like we had in 1964, and it looks like we're several hundred years between earthquakes of that severity. And that was a magnitude 9.2. So we wouldn't expect to see another 9.2 right away. But there's other faults, other things that can rupture and may not be to the magnitude of what we had in 1964, but could certainly be dangerous. There's, for example, the Castle Mountain Fault up here in the valley. There's unknown buried faults in the South Central Alaska region that are associated with the plate interactions that we have in South Alaska. As far as having an earthquake again like we had in 1964, the best thinking today is that, yeah, there's several hundred years between when that's likely to happen again. But there's certainly a strong likelihood of other big earthquakes happening in the region. not like, say, the 1964, not from the same source of 1964, but from other sources.
Is there any question of being able to predict whether, even if not precisely, but sort of in general, that an earthquake is coming, or do you think that we'll never be able to do that?
Well, I think someday we'll be able to do it, but we're just not there yet. The best people can do nowadays is to look statistically at what the rates of earthquakes are in certain areas and see when the last time an earthquake has occurred has been. And we're basing that on not a very good set of statistics because they don't usually occur very often in our recorded history. But there are places where scientists have made an estimation of what the likelihood is of an earthquake is and based that on expected return rates for earthquakes in that zone and when the last time they occurred. So in a general way, we can set probabilities for regions, but there's no real short-term forecasting like you would have for weather.
Right. It's just being aware of that it could happen any time, which I guess is what creates complacency. If it could happen any time, you sort of forget about it. I guess I had another question about tsunamis before I let you go. I think, a lot of us spend time in coastal communities that are potentially vulnerable. And I think particularly like of Homer Spit or Seward, of course, was hit with a tsunami in 1964. Never having experienced a tsunami, one doesn't really know how high you would need to go or what you would need to do if you're, say, standing on, obviously, if you're standing on Homer Spit and a tsunami hits, you probably going to need to be out of there. But how far away from the shore do you need to go? Until seeing these films of Japan, I never even crossed my mind that a tsunami could go miles inland. What sort of advice do you give to communities when they say, well, we need to set up evacuation routes? How far away how high do people need to be?
Yeah, the State Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management has an ongoing project, and they're using the scientists up at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to determine exactly that for all the communities along Alaska's threatened coasts. So communities like Seward and Kodiak have already been completed, and based on the worst expected earthquakes and tsunamis, they've propagated how or modeled how far the wave will propagate inland and provided that to the communities to set as their tsunami hazard zone. And a lot of these communities have signs that say evacuation this way and evacuation as tsunami hazard zone signs. You might see those down in Seward if you're driving around. So in communities like that have been mapped out well, the tsunami hazard zones are defined by signs and by brochures that the communities can provide to you. In areas that haven't been mapped so well or in areas that are never going to be mapped because they're not communities, a good rule of thumb is 100 feet above sea level. If you can't get 100 feet above sea level, get to a mile inland. As the Japanese tsunami showed, that's not always enough, but that's the general rule of thumb we use is 100 feet above sea level or a mile inland, and you're likely to be safe. Other possibilities are if you're somewhere else, say you're down in Hawaii, which experiences tsunamis too, and you can't evacuate inland. Third story or higher in a concrete structure is usually considered safe.
I see. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Paul Whitmore, the director of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We're glad you're there. Thank you for doing your work and protecting us from tsunamis.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. For listeners, we have a website, kska.org, where you can find a number of links to resources related to the people we're talking to, and the Tsunami Warning Center is there. And in the second half hour, we're going to be talking about the preparations we make in terms of building structures and so forth, and you'll find a lot of that kind of background, and also the preparations that you can be making to make sure that when an earthquake hits, you have what you need. So we'll be doing that after the break, and I'll also be giving out the phone number so that you can get on the air and ask your own questions as we continue Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is earthquakes, tsunamis, what you need to know to be ready and be safe when the next one comes, because we know it will come. We live in one of the most seismically active places in the world. There's a lot of material that you can learn more on our website at kska.org. And one thing that came in today is a new study from the National Academy of Sciences. U.S. earthquake resilience needs strengthening, which points out that it's been a century since the United States was hit with a catastrophic sort of earthquake, such as the one in Japan or Haiti. And there is a certain amount of complacency and additional preparation that needs to be made. You'll also find links there to the Tsunami Warning Center, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, earthquake information from the Geophysical Institute, and from our municipal emergency management agency. For the second half, I've got a couple of guests that I know that you're going to want to talk to. So if you would like to call in, please pick up the phone and call 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And if you're outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And email is hometownalaska@kska.org to share your question, concern, or memory about earthquakes. So my guests in the second half are John Aho, who is the chairman of the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission and is also an engineer with CH2M Hill. And I thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And on the phone, John Madden, who is the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, who is traveling and was kind enough to take the time to call in. Mr. Madden, thanks for being with us.
It's always a pleasure, Charles.
I imagine that the division has had a lot of additional inquiries since the tragedy happened in Japan. It certainly brought home for many people our vulnerability. And has that been your experience? You're hearing more questions and more awareness right now?
Within an hour after the earthquake and with the first predictions of the advisory from the tsunami, we have had many, many inquiries from local and national media looking for the story. And the story first was, what do you think about Japan? But now it's evolved in the right way of, how can Alaska learn from this? And that's a very good trend, and that we've been pushing that preparedness message quite a bit.
Well, where do you see, what is the number one message that you would like our listeners to hear in terms of, now we've got your attention with what's happened in Japan, here's what we need you to know?
Well, earthquakes and tsunamis are the events that give no notice. Earthquake can happen any time, and the tsunami, a distant tsunami may give us hours, but a close shore one to Alaska will give us only minutes. The real lesson right here is that every single Alaskan living in any of the danger zones must do three things. One is get a kit, two is make a plan, and three, be informed. And that's how they're going to help themselves in that short notice. When the earthquake hits, it's not the time to start going through your pantry and pulling out things to bring with you. You need that kit standing in that front closet, ready to go, and so you can protect yourself and your family. that's the primary thing for the public to learn from this tragedy in Japan.
Because we've seen the hunger and thirst of the people who were there, though, of course, their homes, for a large part, were just completely demolished. But assuming your home is not just flattened to the ground, there are certain supplies that would get you through a little while until the authorities are able to help you.
You have to plan for more than just the single event. It's not just the ground shaking. That can cause things like power outages, damage to water systems, damage to communications lines. So all of those things, you have to be able to deal with the effects and deal with it for your own protection and that of your family. So it is food and water and if you need medication, you need to have that. And very important that this will not be so convenient that you'll be all together with your family when this thing strikes. So therefore, you have to plan for your family to be separated, children in school or parents at work. And how do you contact one another? And in most of the earthquake areas that have happened in recent years, it's more difficult to call local than it is to call long distance. So if everyone has a card with the contact information of a trusted friend or relative outside of the state, that's a very good thing.
So in other words, everybody calls grandma, and then grandma fills everybody in on what's going on with the family.
Grandma would be a very important partner on this.
I see.
And,
yeah.
And to share it with other family members so that not everyone is trying to call into the state to find out the status. So you can kind of keep the phone lines available for the true emergencies and not just how goes it.
Well, the other aspect of being prepared, of course, is having safe buildings to live in. And to talk about that topic, I'd like to turn to John Aho, who's an engineer and who chairs the Seismic Hazard Commission. Tell me a little bit about the commission and what work is done to make sure the built environment is ready for what might come at it.
Well, the Seismic Commission is comprised of 11 members from various disciplines, and we're currently working on such things as design and construction of critical structures. We're looking at some of the insurance issues that are a problem for earthquake insurance in Alaska right now. We're also looking at hazard identification, earthquake scenarios where we develop a scenario based on a certain type of earthquake and then look at the infrastructure response to that type of earthquake. So those are several things that the commission is looking at right now. As far as the built environment is concerned and what's being done in the main Alaskan communities, they subscribe to the International Building Code. So buildings are built in accordance to code in the major communities. There's a lot of communities in Alaska that don't have building codes, and that's somewhat of a problem. But that uniform building code within it is the seismic design provisions. And the seismic design provisions are difficult to use for somebody that's not really familiar with them. And so, in my opinion, you should almost serve something like a residency in seismic engineering before you start doing seismic engineering. Other types of engineering where you're calculating the size of beams and columns is relatively straightforward, but earthquake engineering isn't. It requires a lot of experience. You have to know about redundancy of structures and ductility of structures and be able to design structures that have alternate load paths in case of failure or can withstand the inelastic strain that a structure is subjected to. And so it's really important for people to have that experience before they design these types of structures.
From the point of view of the ordinary citizen, they move into an apartment or buy a house and they don't necessarily know even what seismic zone they live in. If it's like the seismic zone 5 that's the most susceptible to ground failure, or if it's not that bad, and then they certainly probably don't know the engineering specs of the building that they're moving into. How do we in our community make sure that the buildings are safe? We had a caller, Dr. Selkrig, a minute ago, who talked about three of our slide zones from 64 have been rebuilt. What do we do, and do we need to go back and relook at old buildings to make sure they're safe?
Well, you know, that's one of the things the Seismic Commission is doing, is recommending, as far as schools are concerned, to go back and look at some of the older schools in seismically active areas to ensure their seismic resistance. You know, as far as building, the only way you can really ensure that a building is going to survive an earthquake is if it's built in an area where you're not going to have massive ground failure, you're not going to have a tsunami, because the only thing that codes really address are the ground shaking mechanism. Ground failure, ground rupture, and tsunami are not really addressed in codes, and there aren't design techniques that are really useful. And so when a person designs, or a firm designs, a major structure in a tsunami area, they're designing for ground shaking and ground failure, not ground shaking, and not these other aspects. So a person that's residing in an apartment house, nobody is going to tell them that they're in a danger zone.
Right.
And that's unfortunate as far as I'm concerned. I think we can serve the public a lot better by worrying about where we're building these facilities, as opposed to trying to make the loads larger and the analysis more complicated. Siting of structures is very important.
Well, as we look at Anchorage, obviously the Turnagain area slid, L Street area slid. Should we have zoned off those areas, or how do you feel when you see buildings go up there? Does that give you concern?
Well, you know, that area that slid certainly has reached a new level of stability, but they're certainly under a very strong motion earthquake. There's still the danger of ground failure in that area, and certainly the bluff areas behind that, though they may have been buttressed somewhat by the failure, are still in somewhat of a danger. And, you know, I've been a member of the Geotechnical Advisory Commission since its inception.
That's a municipal commission.
Yes, a municipal commission. And we fought pretty heavily against building down in the old Turnagain Slide area. But people like the view, and they're willing to take the risk that's associated with having that view. And when it comes to single-family residents, perhaps that's their right. When it comes to multifamily residences and major structures, I think that's a different story.
Yeah. Now I'd like to turn to Peter, who had a comment about the Turnagain area. Peter?
Yes. In fact, what this gentleman was talking about actually covered what I was going to say. I was here on the night of the earthquake. I was in the nursing office at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. But I was concerned that, it's my understanding that back in somewhere in the 1940s, a geological survey stated that the Turnagain area was too unstable, or would be too unstable in an earthquake, to support even single family dwellings. And somehow that this got lost in somewhere along the bureaucracy and allowed people to build. And at that time, as my memory serves me correctly, there was a fund that basically came from the taxpayers, that the homeowners paid $1,000 and then the rest of their mortgages were forgiven. And in fact, they were then given plots of land elsewhere in Anchorage. But they still retained the ownership of the original plots of land. And these are the ones that are going to be rebuilt on. And my question is, in the next earthquake, which we know is going to come at some point, will we be on the hook for further funds to reimburse the people again?
All right. Well, we've got three questions there. I can, just from my knowledge, I think what happened with those folks whose houses were destroyed in the quake is that their property was condemned. They received property on the hillside in the Zodiac Manor area, and due to some kind of bureaucratic error, the deeds to the original property were never ceded back to the government, and so others were able to obtain those, clear the title, and then sell them. And I think that's how that came about. I'm not aware of a study that was done in the 40s, but I know there have been studies since then looking at the ground failure. John Aho, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any 1940s study. And I think, I'm not sure USGS was around. That was probably Coast and Geodetic Survey back then.
There's only about 3,000 people in Anchorage at the time,
yeah.
all downtown. Yeah.
Right. And there have been several studies of the area since the 1964 earthquake.
Okay, thanks, Peter. I'm going to go on to another caller. Gretchen, did you have a question?
Yes. Do you recommend homeowners have an earthquake policy? Because I inquired about that with my insurance company, and they told me that, you know, it wasn't really necessary.
Let's turn to John Madden. He's the director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Is that advisable to have an earthquake policy on your home?
Well, insurance is always going to be a personal issue about what you can afford and how much risk you're going to accept. The areas within Anchorage and the rest of Alaska are pretty well defined as about what areas are likely to shake more than others. And with my good friend John Aho said, we don't have a good knowledge about the ground failure or slippage. So you really have to say, if it happens, will I be better off with or without that? And there's no position that we're going to take other than just how much risk do you think you'll be able to take, and what kind of loss will you have? It's a very difficult question because there's so many different areas of the city and of the state, and it's not an equal risk.
Okay.
Is it possible to get? I've been told that there's less availability of earthquake insurance, and my agent told me that because I've had it for a long time, I can keep it. But if I tried to get it now, it would be harder to get. Is that an issue, John?
That
yes.
is.
Oh, you're both
that,
named
that,
John.
That is an issue, and it's an issue not just within Alaska. It's a growing across the entire insurance industry. There is a seismic aspect of this that they're studying, but it's also there's a flooding and hurricane aspect as well. As to what are the actuarial tables for have a potential payout. So it's a very difficult thing to decide as a consumer, but then it is there's a decreasing market for insurance against these other external hazards.
Mm-hmm. Our seismic commission actually has a working committee on insurance and is looking at the issue of earthquake insurance in Alaska.
Our time is flying by quickly, so if you have a call, get it in now at 550-8433. One question for you, Mr. Madden, which is from the point of view of sort of the government emergency management perspective, is that I think there's a belief in some people's part that if there's a major event, the government is going to come in and make them whole, and so therefore maybe they don't need to prepare with insurance or prepare in other ways. How is that handled? I mean, we hear about this idea of moral hazard, right? If you always think somebody else is going to bail you out, you don't prepare. And how do you deal with that? And is that an accurate perception that people have that the government pays for everything after a disaster?
Well, it is a perception in the public, but unfortunately, it is not accurate. There's no government program to come in and make people whole. The measures that are available, both in the federal government and the state, will at best get you back up to one knee. It'll help you up to get a start, but it will not restore you to where you were before the disaster. So that is a need for proper building. And if you live in an older building, the proper retrofits for it. And to have the proper insurance within within how much your risk you're willing to take. But it is not true that government in all its forms will come in and make you whole. Government will be able to help, just as volunteer organizations will be able to help, and faith-based and community-based organizations will be able to help. But no one should have the expectation that they will be made whole and therefore don't prepare. You must have a way to prepare and protect yourself, your family, and your home.
Yeah. Mr. Aho, did you want to add to that? I saw you nodding.
No, I totally agree. When we did our damage investigation after the 2002 Denali earthquake, many of the rural community members really thought the government should come in and take care of repair of their houses. And of course, they were told that that was not the case.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go to Lauren now, who had a comment about planning. Lauren?
Yeah. Hi. I've been listening to your program, and I was just curious, you know, one of the steps that you guys said was to be informed. And I was just curious, when you're trying to decide, you know, where to meet your family after an emergency, you know, how can you decide where the best place is to meet, you know, like in the Anchorage area, for instance? And how would you be informed as to know, like, where is a safe area at that time?
Mr. Madden, that's a good question. How do you make sure this plan is actually going to work?
That is an excellent question, because on making that plan, you have to be able to have a primary place and something else if that fails. If it's just a fire in the house, everybody will assemble over by our neighbor across the street. That may be sufficient for that. But if it's bigger and widespread, then you need a place where you know people are going to congregate. Schools, shelters, public buildings, a church, something where everybody knows where it is. And when you get there, there is a strong likelihood that there'll be a system in place that will get you some help, get you a meal or water or access to medical. So you have to do it for the small, medium, and large. And what I do with my family is every month or so, I'll make a call to my family and said, now, let's go. Let's all meet at our primary place. And then they'll get to know, wherever they are in town, how many bridges do they have to cross? Are there any streams? Are there any areas that may be broken off? And to start thinking about how you get to there. And it's going to vary a little bit with the ages of children and whether they're in daycare or whether they're at school. If anyone has medical conditions, all of those are the things that you need to consider. And if your home is, if it survived and it's safe, that should be the primary. But you got to have another place, and a place that can be reached by each member of your family.
I've read that after the 64 quake, people kind of, there were no utilities, there was no power, no light, no water, and people went to the only place they saw light, which was some of the hospitals that had emergency generators, and they started to congregate there, which I guess is what you're saying is go to the place where they do have the backup equipment. And let me just follow up on that. You know, we live in a place where almost everything we eat and use is brought here on a ship or an airplane, and I've been told that we have about 2 weeks of supplies if that umbilical cord to the rest of the country was cut off. Is that something that you, either at the Hazard Commission or at the Department of Homeland Security, think about? It's, well, how do you feed all these people if the port is destroyed or something like that?
Well, that's something we plan for very intricately, because it's a joint partnership. There are public ownership of some of the airports and the port and the highways, but it's a private sector who owns the ships and the goods and the barges. So we are working with private sector, not only in Alaska, but out of the Seattle and Tacoma area and the ports. How do you work through the challenges of a disrupted supply chain? And what are the alternate ways? And that's one of the reasons I'm in Fairbanks today, is to work through some of the problems that if we cannot receive goods in Anchorage during a disaster, what role will Fairbanks have? And how do we make this so we have a lot of solutions to this? It's a very, very intricate way. And it works day to day. And there's an equilibrium in that supply and demand and supply and delivery. But it's a very tenuous equilibrium. So we work constantly on how can that be broken, then how do we rapidly fix it to stabilize, and then how do we fix it for longer term?
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing that. And then I'd like to turn to Mark now. It sounds like he has more of an engineering question. Mark?
Oh, hello. This is kind of off the topic you're talking about. But after the 64 earthquake, as they rebuilt the buttress area and such, they put in some vertical pipes that are about 6-8 inches in diameter. There's little cones that sit up above them on top. Looks like a little electrical something is attached near the top. And I'm told they go down into the ground to dry out the Bootlegger Cove clay, so it's not as likely to shift. When they put in the Fifth Avenue Mall, they just took them out. But they still exist along Christensen Drive and the Park Strip. And I'm wondering what they connect to underground.
Mr. Aho, do you know anything about that?
I have no idea what that might be. They did have some instrumentation to look at any ground movement after the earthquake, but I'm not familiar with anything that could stabilize the Bootlegger Cove, Clayton.
I can picture what he's talking about, but I don't know what it is either.
You know, we do have 42 channels of or 42 instruments around Anchorage that measure ground accelerations throughout the city. So we're able to look at the seismic wave as it moves across the city from an acceleration standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have the Atwood Building instrumented with 32 channels of instrumentation. So we can look at translatory motion, torsion, interstory drift, foundation rocking. We have 6 instruments in Delaney Park down to 200 feet. And we can look at the incoming seismic wave, relate that to the building response of the Atwood Building, and look at what's called site structure interaction. So,
well, thanks for the call. And if anyone knows, we'll maybe put that up on the website and see if we can pass it on.
Okay. So the instrumentation they're talking about, how recent is that? What kind of vintage?
The seismic instrumentation.
Yeah.
It started. We started instrumenting about 8 years ago. So it's all within the last 8 years.
Okay.
All right. We're running out of time, so let me grab a couple of other questions here. An email question. Does Dr. Aho feel the Port of Anchorage expansion project is using technology that is appropriate for that location? Has it been sufficiently analyzed and shown to his satisfaction it'll be safe and operational? Tough question for just a couple of minutes, but it's the best you can do, maybe.
I think the Port of Anchorage design analysis has been fairly substantial. I think, the Geotechnical Advisory Commission has asked some fairly straightforward questions of the port as far as the review process during design and any outside peer review of that particular design, and the commission is still waiting for answers from that standpoint.
Okay, great question. And one really quick one to finish up. I know there are maps here. You can look up your flood hazard, and I've seen maps of earthquake ground failure probability. Does either of you gentlemen know how a homeowner or a resident could look up on a map as to how much earthquake hazard there is in their particular part of the city?
The municipality of Anchorage has the Harding Loss and Ground Failure Susceptibility maps that were developed in 1979, and they're always available upon request from the municipality. And then USGS did a recent report to update that. And
right.
So that those are available too.
We'll see if I can find a link and put those online. I want to thank all of my guests. In the studio with me has been John Aho, who's chairman of the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission and is an engineer with TH2M Hill. On the phone, I've had John Madden, director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And earlier, we heard from Paul Whitmore from the West Coast Alaska and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, and from Jack Roderick, an old-timer who remembers the 64 quake. My name is Charles Wolforth. Kristen Spack has been engineering today's program. I will be with you again next week, when we will be talking about a lighter subject, planning for your summer adventures, getting outdoors and figuring out what you want to do in the great Alaskan wilderness. So thanks. Be with us next time on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.